Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, presented by AT&T 5G. I'm Andrew Reed with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, Kaylin Carr, David Goss, live on Twitch right now with Wando, full retirement mode from Chris. It's a big show. It's a big Monday. Week 6 is in the books. How do you feel, Kaylin, about seeing, as we all know, I've been told many times, it's practically, you know, branded in our brains, your youth soccer days teammate, Chris Wondolowski, out here flexing at the GA Cup in retirement. Sunglasses on the back of his head, cap on, just living that, like, GA Cup Frisco lifestyle, man.
He looks like he instantly transformed into a baseball dad, so I'm concerned. I'm gonna have to reach out to him.
Are those real Oakleys or fake Oakleys? You buy those on a table at a tournament somewhere, Chris?
No, there's some legends down at GA Cup. I'm getting some FOMO. I saw Bradley Wright Phillips is there, Justin Mapp, Wando, of course, bunch of names. So David Goss, man, again, he gets all the cush gigs.
You just could have put him in the legends as well. He's certainly a Frisco legend. Check out the streams on Twitch. It's Dave. It's Bobby Warshaw. It is the best players, youth players, in North America. In many cases, the world. You got a lot of teams coming in, River Plate, etc. Really raised the level. Really fun to watch those streams. So tune into those. Before we get into what's on today's show, we're breaking down in Week 6. I want the best thing that you saw in Week 6. Doyle, the siren is going off in the background, which means I'm throwing it straight to you for the God's honest truth. What's the best thing you saw in Week 6?
Well, first of all, the God's honest truth, is that must have been Kaylin's.
That's
siren.
Me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You just assume it's Doyle, though, at this point.
No business happening here. But no, the best thing I saw was, everybody watched El Tráfico this weekend. You know that there was a somewhat controversial call late in this game when a apparent LAFC equalizer...
Though?
It was not. An apparent LAFC equalizer was correctly VAR'd away. And because there was such furor among certain parts of the fan base, Pro actually released on their Twitter feed a video explainer of how and why LAFC were offside. Not once, but twice.
That's the beauty of this. It's literally the first one is so blindingly obvious. If you've read the offside law, if you've acquainted yourself with it at all, if you have ever in your life, like, perused those words and thought to yourself, okay, how do I interpret this? What's a deliberate play on the ball? The moment that's hit, you know it's offside.
Yep.
Literally the moment it's hit.
Yep.
Wait. And I love that you guys are saying that there's no way you could ever confuse
zero.
This. Okay.
If you knew the law.
Right.
Which is
if you read the book, that changes every 2 years,
the good
anyways.
Book.
And
that's
to be
true.
Fair, yeah,
it's actually every year that it changes.
To be fair, they do change it a lot. But I just love getting the explanation from Pro rather than those clowns at instant
Idiots.
Replay.
Morons.
Best thing I saw this weekend.
Complete bums. Zero lifetime. Well, actually, I have refereed some games at like the U5 level, but
there you go.
You know. Stayed at a certain hotel chain, which gives me the opportunity to be an expert every single week on instant replay. Go check it out. Charlie and I did break that one down. It's offside. But that was a dramatic game we'll get to here in a little bit.
It was
bit.
Helpful
Kaylin?
for those of us that don't read the books all the time. It was helpful, I think, for a pro to be able to get that window into it. Because even the second part where they broke down, like, this was looked at more as like a shot on goal and how that changes and doesn't reset the play.
Yeah.
That was like extra clarification for me.
Yeah, you've got to – and look, I'm mostly joking out there. If you're taking offense to this
– like me.
The only reason that it's so obvious to me is that I spend every single week trying to just like break down the verbiage in these laws and figure out how it applies to plays. And the quote-unquote save versus a block versus a deliberate play on the ball in that moment, the second offside – it is very confusing. Even Charlie was confused. I had to school him on the show, and I think they cut that out. But I'm here to tell you he was wrong, and I hope he admits that in a public forum.
San Jose's 16-year-old goalkeeper, Emi Ochoa, is having an absolute blinder against River Plate right now.
This Did kid, I see it, that was like, was Quakes B? U16B?
Yeah, U17B. I'm not sure if the B designation it means what it usually means, but River Plate's been on the front foot, and like I said, I mean, Ochoa's having a blinder, but like Ochoa is, other than Slonina, he's considered, I think, the best goalkeeper prospect in the U.S. pipeline. The Quakes signed him as a 14-year-old. I'm actually a little surprised he's playing in this game, but like he stands out. Can't miss talent.
Go tune in. It's really fun. It's an awesome tournament. If you see the behind the scenes of these kids celebrating and the dramatic moments that just seem to pour out of the GA Cup, you're missing out. Go check it out. All right, Kalen, give me your best thing you saw in MLS Week 6.
I'm going to go down to Miami. And this has not been a place where you would say the best thing you saw.
Not from a Miami perspective, from, you know, the opposing perspective.
Yeah, but no, but I would say, like, good for that. Like, one, good for them to come out and get a crucial result, their first win of the season. I believe it's their sixth game. The only other point I think they had this year was the first match, which was a 0-0 draw at home to Chicago. And then since then, I think they'd conceded 13 goals, scored 4. So things were going bad in a bad way. And then when I think back to last season, they played against the Revs. It went bad with that 5-1 loss at home, which I think was just like a really low point for that club at that point. So for them to just really find some footing was big. But I think the moment that stood out in kind of a comic way, in a way, was when Campagna scores, they kind of cut up to Gonzalo Higuain, who's just like sitting there in the crowd. Doyle, no offense, I'm just going to have a little bit of a go. But yeah, he didn't look too excited. He didn't look too pumped up.
Doyle's way more animated right now.
Handsome man.
I know this is family. Gorgeous. Not to come after fam, but yeah, it was funny because I just feel like, in a way, I felt like the team watching Inter Miami had almost like a release in a way without him, and a response that showed, hey, you know, maybe without the DP or without the star, you actually saw the group come together in a way that they hadn't in the past. And I think they were able to play different. And Campagna being 21 is different as well. And he took his chances quite well. So there's going to be some question marks as far as decision making goes, because I think Higuain's hopefully supposed to be back next week, at least according to Neville. But for this one, just that little moment where they kind of cut up to the crowd and it's like, things are going well.
Yeah, that sneaky producer. He had that shot set up. He was like, all right, we're going to go. If Campani gets a goal, we are cutting immediately to Gonzalo Higuain. But do we know that that's Gonzalo? Because I haven't literally seen Dave in Frisco. That could be a voice being piped through. He could. I don't know.
He was just on screen. I can confirm that David Goss is in Frisco. Confirmed. Plus,
got it.
You know. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Maxi Arruti is my best thing I saw in Week 6. We have Tom hitting us up on Twitter saying, "Is Maxi Arruti the greatest player from Newell's Old Boys Academy of all time?" And who am I to argue? Probably is what I would say about that, no doubt. But the Maxi Arruti playing possum moment in Austin's win is just, I mean, I think Maxi Arruti scoring the absolute banger and bringing out the bow and arrow was one of my best thing I saw on week X, like 2 weeks ago. Well, I'm back on the Maxi Arruti train because he does what Maxi Arruti does, which is just a little bit of contact, goes down, has a little bit of a roll, does the thing where he sort of pops his head up and like gets a look, and he's like, oh, we're in a good crossing position. Jumps up, ball to his feet, goal, celebration. Certainly was never injured, but managed to find himself unmarked after going down in the box. So maybe a wonderful goal from Maxi.
The best part of that, too, is like he's down so long that there's time for like three guys on Minnesota to tell him to get up. So I saw like Will Trapp. I saw a number of guys be like, get up, like, get up, man. And he's like, all right.
Yeah, you're right.
Which is just like so infuriating to like add to that. And then the full celebration, like just completely magically healed. So it was just that was an amazing moment. And I'm sure just infuriating because if you're on the other side and you're just like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Loon's got to be pretty frustrated by that one. All right, here we go. Coming up today from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios, we'll go through Doyle's biggest Week 6 takeaway. We've got El Tráfico. It delivers again, and so does Chicharito. We talked through the refereeing calls. We probably won't do that again. Philly, the only unbeaten team in MLS. 5 straight wins for the first time in their history. Texas, all won in the same weekend for the first time ever. All three teams getting dubs. We will break those down. We'll talk about what's going on with the Revs, Charlotte's Olympico that beat Atlanta, do some rapid-fire quick hits through the rest of the league, hit the CCL preview where we have somehow the Lord's Prayer MLS version. That ought to be interesting. And then we'll hit the mailbag for some thoughts on Gio Reyna's latest injury. Let's start then with your biggest Week 6 takeaway, Doyle.
Just that there's a lot of teams that are still like very much a mess. It feels like a disproportionately large amount of the league is just trying to figure it out right now, and like maybe have already scrapped their preseason blueprint for how they want it to play in order to get something out on the field. It's a little more pragmatic, a little better able to cobble together results, and it caught me a little bit by surprise, because after the last two years, this is the first time in a while that we've had a semi-normal season. It seems like that normal start to the season has actually thrown teams off, I guess. I don't know. It's been weird. It's been choppy. It's tough to tell who's good, who's bad. I mean, I'll give you one example. By the underlying numbers, and usually around 7-8 games in, the underlying numbers start to be pretty accurate in terms of revealing who's good and who's bad. Cincinnati are one of the best teams in the league by the underlying numbers.
Yep.
Do we really believe that? I don't think we do. So it's
I would love for there to be an alternative standings at MLSsoccer.com on XG wins.
Oh, Ben, our guy Ben Wright does that every week on his Twitter feed, and he gets absolutely savaged by the fit. Like, I don't know why anybody goes on Twitter, but like,
well, I'll be there. I'll see you this week, Ben. I'll be there to savage everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I might invite him onto the power rankings tomorrow to host it with me, since you're hitting vacation
Deuces.
Time. So
staycation, yeah. Baby, going on a nice hike with the boys and the wife. So yeah, I'll be listening in one ear on the hike while my wife yells at me to get off my phone.
do not listen to the power rankings show while you're on staycation with
Mindy. This is Twitter Spaces, okay? It's Twitter. It only happens live. I can't go back and listen to this. I need the content.
Those
right
are like
now.
Two very different emotions too. One's you're supposed to be like really zen and unplugging, and like the power rankings, which is supposed to just get you riled up, you know.
speaking of a mess, also the goalkeepers. This weekend, yeah. Doyle, you had a very tidy rundown of the howlers, the biffs, the just unexplainable moments this weekend from the keepers. It was strange.
I mean, utterly like shocking stuff.
Yeah.
From, like, Eloy Room had, like...
He threw it in his own net.
Is one of the all-time great goalkeeping errors in MLS history. And, like, there were... maybe two others, maybe three that sort of have a chance to, or you would have in a normal week, like led all the headlines. It was a weird weekend. It's been a weird start to the year in MLS.
All right, let's get into El Tráfico, and remind you to go check out Doyle's column every single Monday, The Armchair Analyst. Sometimes Sunday nights. I like it when they come out Sunday night. I can get that in before I go to bed. So El Tráfico, part of me is like, God, I don't want to lead the show with this again. And I looked at our download numbers from the last show, and of course we led with El Tráfico, and I feel like outside of the LA fan bases, maybe there's a little bit of fatigue with the hype train on it. And I'm sort of like lukewarm, but I watched the game, and it was a really fun, entertaining game at the same time, and it just always seems to deliver, Kalen. Chicharito is delivering. Raheem Edwards is delivering. Samuel Grandsire is absolutely delivering. And LA got a little bit fortunate to knock off LAFC in this one, but they won't care. This is an emotional win for them. And what continues to be probably the most high-profile rivalry game this league has to offer right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the special intrigue with this one was with the main characters, right? With Chicharito, who delivered again, and then as well with the with Vela, who was so close, unlucky in a lot of ways. And I feel that way. I couldn't help but feel that way for LAFC. With some of the decisions, and I know we went into the late one, which felt like the equalizer late, and I still, not to go too far into the instant replay thing, but I still felt like Depuy makes a play on that first one. The second one, once that's why I felt like it was clarified. That second clarification of that shot changed it for me, where it says, okay, that's hard to argue with. But then also, if you go to the first half where Vela scores that's generally a play from what I've heard that you're supposed to leave the flag down and then go to instant replay, and then you have to go or then go to video review and then have to make that call. I said I wasn't going to go into instant replay.
I know. Let me just provide like my learnings from many, many plays reviewed and many offside borderline plays reviewed. What really tricks you in really every broadcast in the world is the angle that they're showing you. So it's not directly down that line.
Sure.
It's at a slightly offset angle, usually closer to midfield that you're seeing it. So if you think about if you were looking at a line to your right, let's say, and you're looking at that angle and you see somebody's like barely off on that line, imagine if you moved 15 yards down the sideline to even. That would be exaggerated, and they would be even further off. Generally, that's the way we see it, and we see, you know, the math whiz come in on Twitter and say, okay, well, I measured off these different impact points, and I have his head, you know, and I have trigonometry this and that, and oh, he's actually 8, 9, 10, 12, 2 feet off, etc. That's where it gets tricky, like to base offside calls on camera angles that you just can't trust your eyes on. That's all I would say is like be wary of looking at any video angle that's not directly down the line and saying that's clear and obvious, because the AR is supposed to be there. In this case, they were there and they make the call. I tend to trust the referee in that situation.
Aren't they instructed to, if it's close, to let it go?
Well, that's what I'm saying. My impression is that it wasn't as close as it appeared.
Oh, okay.
Because the camera angle will fool you into thinking it was closer. But yes, LAFC was on the literal brink for much of this game of getting a result. And I understand why they feel unlucky, and it's a supporter's right to feel hard done by. So
okay, so anyways, I mean, it's hard to stay away, but that was a big part of the game, right? It was the result and the talk around the conversation. So that would be point where say, okay, for LAFC, I could see why they feel hard done by or disappointed, or the calls didn't go in their direction in this case. But that happens. On the other side, for the Galaxy, it's funny because I looked so much throughout the season and said it was going to be, at least in the past, it seemed like they had been a pretty right side dominant team as far as their attack goes, and the way they were generating chances was through Araujo. And it seems like early in the season, this left side has really been, incredibly productive for them. And I think Raheem has been a big part of that, and Grant Sear as well, but just like a nice little combination play through there and then finding Chicharito in the box. That second ball from Grant Sear is like amazing. Like he gets the ball, they kind of lofts it over to him. He takes it off his chest and then just sort of instinctively on the bounce is able to just kind of curl it, just tantalizing behind that back line. And Koulibaly does a good job for a center back for sure to get a really nice finish in there. So credit to the Galaxy. And it just feels like they still have like a little bit of a psychological edge over LAFC. And I understand that the series is pretty close if you look at all time, where I think the Galaxy now have 3 more wins in the sort of club series. But when you look at where these clubs have been over the time that they've been here and how good LAFC have been and how not good, I would say, for large stretches, the Galaxy have been, that feels really unbalanced. And it just goes to show that that's the beauty of these types of matches, where you could be lower in the table. In this case, they're both at or very near the top. And I think still for LAFC, like they had as bad luck as they could have as far as Rodriguez going out in the first couple minutes. We still have Arango comes in. He makes a difference. They just needed that sort of finishing cutting edge. And even Vela still finding his form. I mean, it's crazy to say because he had a goal. But he hit one off the post, the goal that was called back. But it's almost like in a game where he's just a little bit sharper, you could see him get 2 goals in that one pretty easily. Yep. So I think this LAFC team is going to still be at and around that top. I know that they are right now, but I feel really good about, especially when they get those pieces all together in a cohesive way, because those front three have only started together 2 matches all season. Whereas the Galaxy, I feel like, are earning more and more trust as time goes on to be able to win matches like this in ways where it actually doesn't have to be 3-2. It doesn't have to be a Chicharito hat trick. Like, they're having some balance on both sides of the ball, the way that they're able to attack and defend. So I think for both teams, they're going to be this type of like was almost like a preview. I think these two are going to be kind of fighting around near the top of the West.
Two teams in the West with 2 points a game or more right now are the teams in LA. The only other team in the league that's doing that, and it's at a higher number because they have 5 wins in 6 games, is the Union. Doyle, I wrote on Friday, looking forward to this game, about how losing Mark Delgado, I'm going back to old habits there. Mark Delgado was going to be really difficult for the Galaxy to replace. He is not exactly the most active defensive player in terms of actions, like measurable actions, but he is absolutely measurable in terms of the way that he sort of sets the tone possession-wise and the amount of ground he covers, the amount he disrupts other teams. I didn't think that they were going to be able to win this game with him out, given their depth issues, especially at defensive midfield. Greg Vandy's talked about these. Sasha Kljestan, not able to go from the start, so it's, you know, it's Vasquez, and I'm like, God, how are they going to cover the, just purely cover the ground that they need to cover to protect this back line? What did you see from Greg Vanney in this game? What have you seen from this team overall this year?
Well, it was Kelvin Leerdam who played at D-mid for most of this game, and he's a backup right back, and they plugged him in at D-mid. I don't love that, given that they have some kids who've come through the academy and given good minutes in the past. I would have rather seen Vanney go in that direction, but like you can't argue with the results. And Leerdam just basically sat in central midfield. He was just a destroyer. Win the ball, pass the ball, don't do anything fancy with it. And that kind of informed the Galaxy's approach. They were much less ball dominant in this game than they have been throughout the year. Now, granted, part of that is game state, right? When you go up early and you're controlling the game state for basically the entire game, you're going to take fewer risks whether or not you have your first 11 out there. So it kind of went hand in hand, but it was a very pragmatic approach from the Galaxy, and the difference is between this year and the last 7 years is that when the Galaxy need to be pragmatic this season, they seem to be pretty good at it. Not great, you know, there were, as Caitlin, as you were saying, like almost felt a little bad for LAFC because they had so many chances to, you know, get one back, maybe get a second back, maybe come out of there with a point, maybe even come out with three. So it wasn't like, peak Nashville or when the Sounders decide that they're fine with 1-0 and like lock it down. The Galaxy still can't do that, but they're much better at doing stuff in that neighborhood than they have been in the past. And so it all kind of, I think it played out according to plan. That said, I think if the Galaxy end up playing a bunch more games that look like this throughout the season, Greg Vanney's not going to be super, super pleased with that, right? Like, he wants to use the ball. He wants his team to be up around 55-60% possession, use that to create chances, to rip teams apart. And that is the identity that he's trying to instill. If you look at the pieces he's acquired, like, Mark Delgado was a part of a team that did that to, like, more success than any other team in MLS history. Ryan Revellison in central midfield. We know that he wants to be on the ball. He's very obviously that type of player. Victor Vasquez, those Toronto roots. Efra Alvarez, obviously much better with the ball than without it. So is Douglas Costa. So is Granser, I think. You know, and when you have that, like, you're going to be a ball-dominant team. But, like, credit to him and credit for that to that team for putting together a type of performance that Galaxy teams have not been historically capable of. By the way, the Quakes just equalized against River Plate. There's no way this is There's no way this is a Quakes
this ain't the B
team, by the way, because it's, in addition to Emi Ochoa,
it's mind games.
Cruz Medina is out there as well. And Cruz Medina is considered one of the very best prospects in American soccer. And he hasn't signed for the Quakes yet, but he's been the best player on the field in this game against River Plate.
I love that you brought up the Granser cross, the second one. Caitlin, the first one was really good too, sort of that float of ball over the center backs. I also thought on both goals that the LAFC center backs were just kind of lackadaisical, a little bit unawares about what was happening in front of them. You could see on that first Chicharito goal, they are just locked in on the ball, whereas that's not the danger. Like, Chicharito is the danger. Like, you've got to track this man, and they don't to the back post. those are moments that I think they'll clean up as well. And Mamadou Fall maybe has both of those to think about as that guy on the back post of like, okay, got to be a little bit more engaged, have to expect either the unexpected or just service to come in. But a big win for the LA Galaxy has them second in the West behind LAFC, who take that L, but still sit atop the standings. Four wins from six games and a +8 goal differential to the Galaxy's +3. So that was the first loss of the year for LAFC, by the way. Other big matches here. Let's talk about the team at the very, very top of the Shield standings. That's the Union, 1-0 win against Columbus. We mentioned how they got the goal in the second minute. Eloy Room quite literally volleyball set the ball into his own net. Like, didn't grab it, just kind of like palm slapped it in. And then the Union held on. And to me, this quote from Jim Curtin basically sums up who the Union are right now. Quote, I don't think we've played great yet. I think we've been good in all the games. We've certainly been sound defensively, but we're not a finished product, which I really, really like at this stage. So there are five wins all in a row here, from most recent to furthest in the past. Columbus at home, Charlotte at home, at NYCFC, San Jose at home, at Montreal. Montreal and NYCFC, of course, distracted by CONCACAF Champions League. Their lone non-win of the year was on opening day against Minnesota at home. So we're talking about four home games, two away games, both the away games against CCL opponents. I'm just giving you context to that. The start of the season is great to them, but it may not be, or certainly will not be, sustainable to be at more than 2.5 points per game through the entirety of 2022. To me, Doyle, and I'll let you check me on this, this is sort of the progression of the Union from a team that was chopping and changing a bunch and at all levels, really, whether it be coaching or in the squad, and has basically figured out that, one, we have a system that works. We have a coach that properly motivates our players, makes good decisions, and can train that system. Our back seven are absolutely rock solid. They've been together for a while. If it's not them, they've got homegrowns that are popping in, especially at the outside back positions, to help spell other guys. They understand each other. They have chemistry. They know what they're doing, and it's really, really hard to break them down. And, oh, by the way, as the Revs are showing us now, it's super helpful to have a best-in-class goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. The question mark comes in the front four, comes in goal scoring, comes in the final third. How do they create chances if the other team isn't just sort of biffing under the pressure that they can apply? And which of the forwards, the age-old question for the Union, are going to be the ones that are consistently productive and dangerous? Like, we had our first game of Michael Ura and Julian Carranza, and there were moments, but there weren't breakthrough moments. And that's what I think Jim is saying about not being the finished product. I think he looks at his team and he says, all right, well, we have the foundation. It's set. It's been set. We're no longer a team that people are going to think of as a yo-yo team. Like, we're a playoff team. The question is, can we reach our ceiling? Will they be able to reach their ceiling if their star striker doesn't get going? Can they reach their ceiling if the DP sort of like scrap heap pull-in they had doesn't show that he truly belongs as a DP? What about Sergio Santos, who's sort of the definition of this uncertainty? What about Corey Burke, who's a really good, you know, reserve forward to come in and spell it when the other guys aren't in form? Like, this is a very good team that we haven't seen the best of, but there is still a question mark of when and if we will see the best of them, just because the question marks when it comes to chance creation and the final third.
I think it's less chance creation than it is putting those chances away. But I largely agree with everything you just said. But like, even in this game, Daniel Gajdag had 2 1v0. You know, one just him versus Eloy Room, and he was not able to finish them. Now, it's a little unfair to pick on Gajdag. He has 4 goals in
he's been the one.
He's been the one
scoring, taking advantage.
Yeah, so, but like, until I see Gajdag do that consistently over the course of a whole season, until I see one of the strikers do that, it doesn't have to be both. It doesn't have to be, you know, they have four, as you said, they have four guys who are all like pretty good. You know, one brings something to the table, takes something off. The other is, you know, kind of balance that. They need one of those guys to just go out there and like be the best number nine on the team and one of the best in the league and get 15 goals and 5 assists and constantly be a thorn in the side of opposing defenses, not just for work rate and link up play, but also for like putting the ball in the back of the net. So, yeah, I mean, you nailed it, Weeby. Like, they're a solid team. They have an S tier goalkeeper. They don't hurt themselves. They know how they want to play, so I think they're pretty good at creating chances, even though it's not elite. But they are lacking that bit of magic in the final third. And if Gajdag turns out to be the guy, Or if Ora or Carranza turn out to be the guy, then, you know, they can answer that question in the affirmative. And then we're talking about a team that becomes prohibitive favorites. But they're not at that level yet. And that's what I think Jim Curtin was saying.
What expectations do you have from them this season, Kalen? And has it changed at all with this hot start?
I mean, I think right now, I mean, they deserve their place, but I think they're probably still the best team in the East and maybe the favorites to win the East right now. I have some of those same concerns. I like Gazdag. I think you could probably count on him to have a better – I mean, already he's had a really strong start, but if he ends up with 12-plus goals, I feel like that's a good place to be. And then you got to hope that just like one of these other strikers can – either equal or better that, but I still think they're in a position where they're going to need to do it by committee. They're going to need to have a number, maybe four or five goal scorers, where you get Bedoya up to 6 to 8, you get a number of guys to kind of chip in from different positions, and then ride that back line all the way to the final. And I think that's the big question for me, was like, they've only given up 2 goals this year, I think, which is I think the lowest in the league alongside Chicago. Yep. And so defensively, this team is very elite. And so the question is like, can you do that through the playoffs and ride that all the way to MLS Cup? And I feel like that question mark is still just sitting there because of what happened last year and the fact that we didn't get to see them host that Eastern Conference final against New York City because of the COVID outbreak. And then that just sort of derailed everything. So I think that question is still unanswered right now as far as how, like, because we talked about having match winners, and we're like, well, there was that quick moment in the game where Andre Blake goes down and he hit the post and he started grabbing his leg, and everybody was like, oh no, like, this cannot happen, right? And there is like that much pressure on him to be there. That's not to take anything away from the back line, but he's just like, he's different. So I just think that I would expect this team to be at and right around it. I think for the top of the East, and I think for Jim, he's been able to say they've built this kind of like winning culture that they're going to win games kind of in all different kinds of ways. But yeah, those same question marks as far as saying, okay, yeah, we found this top striker. I don't know. It doesn't quite look like it yet. You know, I think it's going to have to be more by committee. But I think that still is possible.
Who's the underrated, like, we talk about Andre Blake all the time, Doyle, but when we go into the Union, who's the guy that we don't talk about enough that is truly elite?
There's like 5 of them. I'll say that I think Jose Martinez struggled relative to my expectations for him last year. This year, he's been the best D-mid in the league. But like, Jack Elliott is an absolutely elite center back. Like, if he was American, I would be screaming for him to be in the U.S. national team pool. He's incredible. Nobody talks about him. It's the weirdest thing. And he could do, like, he got range of passing with both feet. He carries the ball into midfield. He fills in at D-mid because he's got such good feet. He's dominant in the air. It's weird how under the radar this guy is.
Congratulations, Union. You're in a position where we're like, well, we want more. Hey, can you deliver on this front? Your strikers aren't really scoring, and you're at 2.67 points per game.
Yeah, that's decent.
Yeah, pretty good indication of the shift. You said it culture-wise, Kalen, but in squad building, in sustainability, and graduating those young players, like just success after success, it seems like, for Philly in this league. For Columbus on the road over the last couple of years, just failure after failure. Three losses in a row here on the trot for the Crew, and it's got to come in painful fashion.
Three wins in 30 on the road for the Crew since the start of the 2020 season.
Well, fortunately for them, they have an MLS Cup in that time. So, nah, what are you going to do? All right, let's shift gears here. William Wieners, powder worker on Twitter. Guys, that shift you felt this weekend was the West tilting from the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico. Interesting thing to say when the only two teams with 2 points per game or more in the West are on the Pacific in LA. But I feel you, Mr. Wieners. You are absolutely feeling yourself. I'm sure you're from Texas. As we said previous, all the Texas teams had never all won on the same weekend, and by God, they got it done. FC Dallas 3-1 against Colorado, Houston 4-3 against San Jose, just absolute chaos, and Austin on Sunday night 1-0 against Minnesota. Let's start with our 22 under 22 player of the weekend presented by Body Armor. That would be Jesus Ferreira. I believe this is maybe his second time in that space this year. What finishing concerns? This man is tied for the Golden Boot with 5 goals, and I liked that they were different types of finishes. Kalen.
Yeah.
I liked that they were – the one was sort of like touch, turn, first-time shot, and then gets in behind, times his run perfectly, and just sort of effortlessly rounds William Yarbrough.
Yeah, the first one was the one that stood out to me as far
as
the one that
– It's an absurd goal, Kalen.
Just to have that sort of presence to and quick trigger. I just remember playing with a guy like Chris Rolfe, who just would release the ball just so quickly. About similar frame, technical, could play a bunch of different positions, almost to the point where people wondered what was his best, what position was he? At the time, there was less tactical flexibility, let's say, in the league as far as finding places for players like that. But when I look at Jesus and his just ability to kind of sense that space near the top of the box, right, and the way that they spread things out, and he kind of just he starts moving, just kind of grazing towards the middle of the pitch, understanding that's where the space is, and then turns with his left and then immediately gets that quick trigger with his right. That's a play where you're thinking, okay, that's elite. You know, that's not a just a, you know, he was in the right place at the right time or finished the action. So, and getting in those kind of soft spots is going to be big, because I don't expect him to be, he does have the pace to get in behind, but I don't think that for the, and you know, this is hard not to color because most of our conversation I'm thinking about the national team in a sense, which is just the subtext because he's trying to get on that World Cup side and stretching the field in the back. I think from Greg's system, it's going to be more of him getting in those soft spots right around that top of the D. So when I see a play like that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's promising. And then also I just think he's so smart as far as like finding the wingers and finding those passes. And so, yeah, I think I never really had much concern about his finishing ability. I think he's got that, but as you see the confidence and that just understanding of space. And I think that part for me, is clearly elite.
What did you see from Dallas as a whole? Should we talk the Brandon Cervania goal now? I mean, my God, good Lord.
He hit that with the devil's magic, man. Like that was absurd.
Felt bad for William Yarbrough, because I looked and I didn't see it on the original because I didn't catch this game live. So I was watching the 15-minute or whatever, and I was looking for the view directly behind Cervania. And finally, last night during MLS After Dark with Charlie, we were talking about it, and I was like, I wish I would have seen that exact angle. And somebody sent it to me. How could you ever hope to stay in front of a ball like that? How do you hit a ball like that? Kalen, help me out from just a technical perspective. Not only did he hit this thing from like Graham Zusi range, if you remember way back when you know, Graham's standing over that free kick in Dallas, like in 2011 or 12 or whatever, and Davey Arnaud's like, yeah, just hit it. And he knuckles that one. I mean, this is from Nowheresville. Like, he shouldn't be able to do this, and it is unstoppable.
Dude, you're asking the wrong person. I'm sorry.
How many direct free kicks did you take in your
I think
career?
I've got like one goal outside the box, maybe two. I have no idea. But like I think I saw like I may have tried that in training once and like broke my ankle trying to do that.
That's what it is, right? You're locking out the ankle basically, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to kind of, and then I think in some ways you kind of I don't know. You see Cristiano, he's the one that kind of like began this type of action as far as with the ball dead, but to hit it while the ball is on the move as it was, is even more impressive because it just shows you how clean he struck it and kind of goes across it where it kind of starts moving at you and you see Yarbrough take one step and the one step was enough to you're dead. You know, it just goes back the other direction. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was an incredible strike. And I think for this Dallas team overall, like, to they are the way that that system works, like they can really get from one end to the other really quickly. Like, they're very dynamic, they're young, they have skill all over the pitch. So I don't know, they're a team where when we went through, I guess this is a good week to kind of maybe retool those rankings, because we were going through like who's the best Texas team and how does this work, and everybody won this week. I still maintain I like what I've seen from this Austin team. I'd put Dallas second and Houston third. It pains me to do that, but I like what I'm seeing from this Dallas team, and I think they've got a lot of potential.
I'd take Dallas one overall.
Would you?
We went into the highlights there, Doyle. Is there is there more something more underlying here with this team as to how they're playing?
They didn't play well. They did not play well this weekend at all. I thought that Colorado was the better team for most of this game, but they got
tells that tale too.
And just like Colorado was able to swamp Dallas through midfield and then constantly get on the move and get on the run and create chances. And they just didn't finish them. And it's funny because this time it was Diego Rubio who actually did finish a chance, and he's usually the culprit, and it's the other guys who have been carrying the load. And in this game, it was Diego Rubio who finishes just beautiful chance from Michael Barrios, and then everybody else went cold. Dallas do this rotation, and it's especially noticeable on the left side where Pomacall drops out of the midfield to give Farfan license to push forward. And I feel like, I have to go back and rewatch it, but I feel like a couple of times in this game, that rotation in particular, Colorado was waiting for it and jumping it and creating turnovers in midfield via superior numbers and getting out because of it. So there's some tactical stuff here that needs to be ironed out for Dallas. They are a much better team than last year. I am usually highly skeptical of burning a international slot on a goalkeeper, but Paas has been worth it. His distribution is phenomenal. But I also came out of this game really impressed with Colorado. Like we know that they are under-resourced in terms of the amount of firepower that they have on hand relative to other teams. But my God, they are so well coached. If they are able to get, one more signing and get it right, then this team is going to be so good. And like, I understand, like, there's got to be frustration in that fan base because they've given up a few soft, like, they should have at least taken a point out of this game. They should have beaten Houston a couple weeks back. Like, they've had some, like, really frustrating results, but this team's good, man. This Rapids team is good.
They're going to be fine. I think if there are two teams obviously below on that West line right now that I just would bet right now to jump no matter the odds, it would be Colorado and Seattle. I'm not going out on a limb there. I think those are two playoff teams, but this is a loss. Yep. For the Rapids, Houston, San Jose, 4-3. What can you say? What can you say? Hey, Sebas got two goals. That was good. Yeah, look, if you're San Jose, I get it. You're not going to mark the number 9 on the other team at the near post on a set piece. You're going to just let him have a free run, let him be wide open, let him have all the time in the world to finish. That is the Quakes' way. I completely understand that. Just keep doing that. It'll serve you well as the only team in the league that doesn't have a win. Jeremy Obobese, two goals. This could be a Doyle gloating moment. These goals were good, too.
He's a good forward, man. We've seen it a million times, but the Quakes are – well, I will say this. The Quakes went back to kind of a 4-2-3-1, and their attack under Almeida has been consistently good until really the end of last year and start of this year, where he changed things up. Well, they went back to what they were doing, and they generated a lot of chances and three goals. These were, I think, the first two open play goals of the season that they've scored. But I give a ton of credit to Paolo Nagamura because – he wanted this team to be a 4-3-3 high-pressing team. He comes from the Peter Vermees coaching tree. And, like, within 2 weeks, he was like, we can't do that. We're not going to be able to do that and get the players that we need on the field in order to collect points. And so it's now a 4-2-3-1. They sit pretty low. It's not like a pure low block, but they sit pretty low, and they just annihilate you on the break with Darwin Quintero pulling the strings as a number 10. They have like three or four different wingers who can get out and fly. And then Coco Carrasquilla, he's so good as a number 8, man. Like, he is so good. So him sitting behind Darwin, they're just like two touches from off to the, not even two touches, they're one touch from off to the races at any moment on the field. I think it's completely different than what Nagamura envisioned heading into the season, but it's so much more fun to watch, and it's getting them results. The Dynamo are what? They're fifth place, fourth place in
sixth
the
place.
Sixth place but in tied, the Western Conference.
Austin, Dallas, and Houston all on 11 points.
There you go. So I give him, like, I really tip my hat in terms of the pragmatism that he's showing here. It's you know, it's not the most complex system that they're playing, but you don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel in order to play fun, winning soccer. And it's not just like mindless long ball, you know, like they're actually putting some stuff together, and it's been great.
One of the best possession teams in the league by the numbers, if you go look at it, which shouldn't surprise a ton, given where he comes from and his coaching pedigree. Sporting Kansas City certainly value that. 4 home games out of 6. I will just say that for the Dynamo.
Yeah. And the other thing, just to kind of do the hard part first, like the reason I had them last in a sense is just the last two, it's against San Jose and Miami, who are both at the bottom of their.
Hold on. We could have waited to do this for Austin, too.
Fair enough. But I just, you know, the one thing I do like Nakamura being able to, especially they score 2 on set pieces and then being able to use the break well, to Joel's point. So I do like what I'm seeing from that perspective. I just got to say it, like from San Jose's perspective, like the way that they give up goals sometimes is just, we do this every week on the show, but it's just maddening where there's literally just a long clearance and Calvo comes up and tries to like chest trap the ball. and then it just completely goes with one pass. They're down the other end. So I don't know when they're going to figure that out, that just teams can just play completely direct and you're going to find chances off them. Because if you just watch the highlights every week, it's just like just chance after chance of them, a single man on San Jose chasing a guy all the way back facing their own net. And then, yeah, they get the save from Marcinkowski, but then the follow-up is there. So San Jose is going to give, I think they have given up the most goals, but I would almost, even compared to Miami, I feel like their defense is more more troubling to watch.
15 goals allowed, Montreal, Miami, San Jose. So those are the worst. Portland has 13 allowed, and you got 14 allowed for, actually, since he had 14 allowed. I don't know. Either way. Bad defensive teams fall under that banner. Austin with a 1-0 win. Let's not replay that first half. I also just have to throw it out there and remind everybody, if they haven't seen the news, Cecilio Dominguez not available for this Austin team. He has been suspended by MLS, pending an MLS investigation into possible off-field misconduct. So he is prohibited from engaging in any team activities during the entire investigation here. So we'll hear more about that in the future. But he has the all-time lead in goals scored for Austin, or he's tied for. So that's an issue for them on the field. But, of course, off the field, things are more important. We know that. Let's talk about this 1-0 win. Let's forget the first half entirely. I don't think there was a single hundredth of an expected goal scored. It was a perfect time to prep for this show. Let me just tell you, I was locked in on everything but that match. But in the end, Maxi Arruti, as we've already outlined, gets the goal. What did this match say about Austin? Let's make it quick. Anybody have a bigger Austin take here? This is their first win since they won in weeks 1 and 2 against Cincinnati and Inter-Miami, which they didn't like people pointing out was not the best competition. But, hey, 3 points at home. Be happy about that. Take the result. Improve the performances down the line, which I think Josh Wolf will be focused on. Anything on Austin here, or do we want to switch over to Minnesota?
I got two quick things on Austin. Their wingers, it's Ethan Finley and Diego Fagundes now, but even when Dominguez was available, none of those guys are beachy off the dribble guys. And a lot of the way that Austin plays, their build-up patterns under Josh Wolf, is designed to put the wingers into position where they can eliminate a defender off the dribble and then sort of create from there, and none of the wingers are good at that. So it feels like they need one more piece in that regard in order to sort of like juice this attack a little bit. And you could see it in the first half, as he said, was abysmal, Weeby. But like Austin was consistently getting their wingers into position where it's just like, if you can beat your man, then like you're going to lay in a cross, or you're going to maybe be able to go, you know, and have a rip on goal. And like, it just wasn't happening. And I think you could have one guy like a Fagundes, who's so clever and smart, good at combining, or, you know, Finley, who's direct and like really good at getting behind. You could have one guy like that out there, but I think it needs to be balanced by a winger who can beat guys off the dribble. That's one. And two is, this offseason, they got rid of, Thomas Pochettino, who was a DP, and it was a good brave move to say, you know what, we're cutting ties with our first DP because he wasn't the right fit, and they went out and they got Johan Valencia, the D-mid. He's more of a pure D-mid from Colombia, and like Valencia has looked so completely overwhelmed anytime he's taken the field in this one. Now, it's not fatal because Denny Pereira, who they drafted, you know, first overall in 2021, has, I think, leveled up in his second year, which is nice to see. But a lot of their scouting in South America has not produced the types of difference makers
that Rodney
you would
Redis.
Hope for. Rodney Redis.
We're talking Romana, about wingers that you would hope, yeah.
I mean, Romana was a disaster at center back. Like, they have to go back and re-examine their South American scouting pipeline because, like they got Sebastian Drusy, and he's fantastic, but, like, and he's a South American player, but they got him from Europe, you know? So there's something off in there for Austin. That said, you know, a good way to become a good team is to start beating bad teams. And Minnesota's a bad team right now, and credit to Austin for getting 3 points.
Well, that's a cue of all the people that – yeah, that's the cue. Well done. You knew it was coming. You really nailed it here. Okay, so I'm just going to run through some mail from folks in Minnesota who are not happy. They're tied for last in the league in goals scored. They've got zero multi-goal games this season. They are below the line on 8 points right now from 6 games in the Western Conference. So Nathan – hits us up. Is it time to acknowledge that Adrian Heath isn't the right person to get Minnesota United to the next level? Mark in Minnesota, longtime listener, first-time emailer. Minnesota United has a deep roster with plenty of talent in attack and defense. Adrian Heath has done a great job assembling it. Unfortunately, his head coach, Adrian Heath, is wasting that roster with head-scratching game plans and inscrutable in-game tactical decisions. It seems that GM Inchi should call head coach Inchi to his office for a tough conversation. Now, Adrian Heath is not the GM, that's Mark Watson, but Mark Watson was an assistant coach under Adrian Heath before he was elevated to that position, so it's pretty clear where a lot of this power lies, obviously. This from Mark, he says, Heath consistently recruits good players and puts them in positions to fail. He mentioned Robin Lude as one of them. This Minnesota roster should be competitive at the top of the West and a serious MLS Cup contender, but the coach that assembled the team can't seem to deploy it effectively. As a Minnesota United supporter, it's hard to be optimistic knowing that there's not going to be any serious pressure to get that right. Then we have Loons Coast to Coast hitting us up with like a hypothetical that's like, if you could move a non-top-tier current MLS coach to another team based on their tactics and the players available, who would it be and why would you move them? And that seems like a very not-so-veiled attempt to get us to talk about who we would have come in and replace Adrian Heath. Is it Adrian? What's going on here? Because when I watch
they're coming off of 3 straight postseason appearances and we're 6 games into the season.
Yeah, people, it's a panic mode. But it tells you probably what these fans have been thinking for a while.
I think the
better question is, are they performing below their capabilities and why?
Yes, they're performing below their capabilities because they've built a heliocentric attack, right? Everything revolves around Emmanuel Reynoso. He is the straw that stirs the drink. He is, you know, the sun, and everybody else is the planets and the comets and whatever the hell else revolves around the sun. And he stinks right now. He was amazing, MVP, beyond MVP level when he came in late 2020. He was best 11 level last year. Like last year, Minnesota didn't score a lot of goals. It's not because they didn't have a lot of chances. They had a ton of chances. Their guys just couldn't finish because Bello was carving up everybody he came up against and giving guys layups that they couldn't finish. This year, he has not been good. He's like 60th in expected assists. He's turning the ball over more often per touch than he used to. And then on top of that, you know, Fragapane was, I thought, very good last year. He has not been this year. Lud has been lost. Amaria is unconscionably selfish.
Not going to pay off that debt.
Yeah. So it's a mess, but it's also like if they figure out what's wrong with Babello, then they're just going to go back to being what they were last year, except maybe this time the variance with regards to finishing is on their side, whereas last year it was against them.
They also seem to have used like in the past, their outside backs would get involved more in the attack with Chase Gasper, who's taken a leave. It's not playing right now. And then Metanier, who just came back in this last match, I believe was his first match coming back. So that's promising. But yeah, the lack of consistency in any of these players, where you would see Ruben Lud for a time, like really fine form and really be good, and Fragapane has shown moments, but the lack to build something kind of cohesive, and at times it just sort of defaults to this idea of giving the ball to Reynoso and being like, all right, dude, like go make it happen. And to Doyle's point, when that's not on, or if another team, you know, game plans around that, that's where it starts to fall apart. I think the back line is, and the defense is solid. It's just tough because you're watching them scramble and understanding, like, if we give up one goal eventually, that's going to be it. And if we get one, we got to make it count. And we can't give up. And so the margin for error, even for the back line, it's a really tough way to go into a match. And I think the back line does have quality. They've been strong. And Dane St. Clair coming in, I think, has been good as well. But it's just there is, like, no margin for error at this point with this team. They're desperate to find anything. I think the other part too is just like Ethan Finley, I understand he wasn't like a world beater in a sense, but he can stretch the back line. I think they don't really have anybody that can. If you don't have the width and then you don't have anything to stretch, then that's how you create space for a playmaker like Reynoso to be able to find space.
And just feels like Reynoso's not in, he doesn't receive the ball in positions to be particularly successful.
Well, he needs people, like, he needs movement around him. Any player like that needs runs to kind of create, you know, space for the playmaker underneath. That's for any system. And it just doesn't seem like there's really any dynamic things. And so then the hard part is if he's losing the ball every time, even if you are one of those players, you're not going to really take a risk and make a run too, because you have to understand that this might actually turn over and you need to be back. So it's just one issue kind of compounds to the next.
If you look at the numbers on Reynoso, I think he leads the league in duels. Could be wrong about that. He's at the very, very top if he doesn't lead the league, which says a lot about what is being asked of him. He's in a lot of situations where defenders are contesting balls with them, and it felt to me, and like, call me out if you think I'm wrong about this, but in the past, especially last year, they really relied on his ability to be super slippery. Like, he would get the ball in those very tight positions, but he had a incredible knack for eliminating that first defender with a touch or a turn or something to get himself into space with his head up moving forward. And that's where you can start to trust the runs. But if he's not able to do that, which he hasn't really been able to do that this year, he's been turned around a lot and then he's lost the ball. Got to find a way to create space for him. Otherwise, if he's going to be, as you said, Doyle, the sun, you know, what's orbiting? Like what's moving around him? What's putting him in a position to be successful? Cause it's a lot of pressure on one guy right now. It's not working out for him. Charlotte 1, Atlanta 0. Let's roll through this one pretty quickly. How do you feel about Olympicos? Anybody love an Olympico? Anybody just really get juiced about Olympicos here? Or you just kind of shrug and laugh to yourself? I'm more of a shrug.
You seem like the type
more of a
to love
shrug
Olympicos,
and laugh
man.
Guy on Olympicos. Like, I know they get a lot of people really seem to love them, yeah. But I'm more like, eh.
Yeah, I'm a shrug and a laugh guy. Like, Olympicos, like, there are occasional ones, like the Thierry Henry one about a decade back, where it's like, He literally pinged it into the upper V, like it was like looping in, yeah. Back post, like that one.
Harris Bandunian had one sort of, yep, like that, yep. For Cincy too.
This was, I feel like this was more Brad Guzan getting too distracted by Daniel Rios and not a great moment for Brad Guzan.
Here's the quote from Guzan: "Quote, the ball got caught in the wind, it took off and settled in the top corner." He says he got caught on the front foot. That sounds accurate, and you know it's a tough moment for Brad, but it's also tough for Atlanta not to score a single goal against an expansion team.
By the celebration. That's what I would say. I remember Henri did that, and he was like kind of running. You know, when you like put up a jumper and you're kind of starting to fade and celebrate already.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was like, oh, surprise. And then it was like, celebrate with your teammates, then go to the corner flag and dance, which I appreciate. And I feel like if you score an Olympico, like you should definitely celebrate.
As if you intended it.
Yeah. 1,000%. But if there's like a little bit of a gap, that's, I think, the tell to say, okay, maybe that wasn't so intentional. But either way, Charlotte will take it.
Jordy Alcevar is the one with the goal here, coming into his own a little bit after a slow start, adapting to MLS. He's said as much. It's been difficult for him. Miguel Angel Ramirez might be the best manager quote in the entire league. He says he called Jordy a un sinvergüenza, which I think basically translates to like shameless SOB for that one. The quote about it, of course, we don't practice Olympico goals from the corner, but Jordy knows how to kick. Thank you, Miguel. Also, Miguel appears to be a manager who peruses transfer market. Here's his quote on this win. This is the magic of football. There's a difference of $80 million between Atlanta United and Charlotte FC's squads. This is why we love football, because anyone can beat anyone. The little engine that could there.
Wait, and he's also Charlotte. He's also just continually talking to the front office. It's just
He's like, did you see their squad? Did you see?
But I actually think that was really smart. Like, if you go back and look at the way he almost instantaneously changed the expectations around his club with his comments in the preseason, I think it was really clever in a way, and it like put his team in a different position and kind of took the pressure off. And we've seen the home fans still, you know, they're going to show up no matter what.
They don't care.
They're hyped no matter what, and they're continuing, and now they're being rewarded with like really good home form. So if they can kind of keep riding that home field, at least, it's going to be tough for them on the road. And I think over time, that gap in talent in certain spaces, or that transfer market, you know, fee that he's referencing, might catch up. But then again, he might just be able to make a better case to say, look where we are right now. If we go out into the transfer market in this next window and add a piece or two here, and we know our team better, maybe they're in a better position where they can actually challenge for the playoffs.
He seems like a really good manager to me, Doyle, just like outside of the stuff that entertains me, the quotes and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Watching what he's been able to do with this team so far, like, it seems like they've picked up. It's not perfect, you know, and especially in the final third, it doesn't always come off, but it feels to me like they've picked up the ideas that he is trying to transmit really quick.
Can I read you something from a interested listener?
Sure.
A fellow by the name of Producent Anders.
Oh.
I was talking with Producent Anders in Slack while watching the game yesterday. This is the Producent Anders take. They have really clear ideas that are borne out in their spacing and their movement. You can see them making decisions about where to go with the ball and build up. If the primary option isn't there, they know where to look for the next outlet. And like you've talked about, they really look good with Rios and Swiderski up front, because both guys can act as outlets with their hold-up play. So when they try to build, one of those two forwards is always an outlet. Bronico has been great in the deeper role, moving the ball. You could see that around the 40th minute when they built from the back. Kalina rolls it out. Bronico takes the space and plays to a man, making a well-spaced run. Charlotte probes the left side, but there's nothing there. They cycle back to Bronico. He picks up his head as soon as he gets the ball and looks for the overlapping run coming from Lindsay down the right, because he knows that's what the position is supposed to be doing in that situation. It leads to Lindsay getting a good cross to the penalty spot.
Mm.
Let's get this guy a microphone.
Wow.
Man,
God.
What are we doing here?
You know, anything but Seattle segments Anders is going to excel on. I truly believe that. I mean, he will be the most hated person on the show of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime we talk about the Sounders. By the way, I don't know if you guys caught it in the chat when I said that El Tráfico was the most relevant or exciting rivalry in the league right now. Or he was having a hissy fit in the chat. But yeah, well said. I think well said. Yeah, and look, they have a lot of turnovers in their own half in the middle third right now, but that's because they're trying to play with the ball and build out. I think he looks like a really good hire for them. Miami 3, New England 2. We've already really talked about the Miami side. Congratulations to them. We have Taft hitting us up, says, what team has surprised you early this season, good or bad? Let's go the bad side. New England, bad.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm pretty surprised.
I hear that.
I mean, I knew it wouldn't be as good as it was last year. I mean, it was just really, like, statistically impossible for that to happen again.
Only thing, you take out Gustavo Bow, you take out Buxa, you take out Tejan Buchanan, and you take out Matt Turner, and tell me what you have.
Well, that's four.
Is it still the same team?
Fair.
Well, I mean, take that type of quality out of, like, your top four or five players out of any team, see what happens. So I think it's not a knock on the other guys or anything like that, but just as far as, you know, even Carlos Hill, like, he benefits from, we saw him play in MLS before they got this talent, right? And he was great, but not like MVP, lighting up the league, singular player, untouchable. And so I just think with that, the Champions League, the disappointment of that, I'm noticing right now even more so like mental fatigue in a way where it's just like when you start losing games late on, like you look at the last two results and even some of the mistakes that they make where it's like, you know, I think Knighton's a quality keeper, and just to like make that mistake where he doesn't quite get a hold of the ball, or even the own goal the week before where it's like Farrell is, you know, one of the better, more experienced center backs in the league, and it's just kind of bad luck. But I think some of those little bad luck things can come from some of that mental fatigue where you a play that just freak accidents, and they're happening late in games, whereas last year, 75th minute on, this team was lights out within a man advantage. I think they had a man advantage last week too and still conceded that late one. So it's just, some of those things start to add up as far as just when things start going the wrong direction. I still think this team will be fine, especially as they get some of these players back. But yeah, I mean, it was, I also think Miami was extra motivated to try and get a result with no Higuain, and then as well as what New England did to Miami last season.
Bruce called it another gift that the Revs gave with that late winner. And I think that's four losses in a row now. It's the first time that's happened to Bruce since 96, first four games of DC United. That's a long time. That's
the more fourth many... of those, the fourth of those games was a draw that turned into a loss in the shootout.
See, that's that historical knowledge that we've that's come great. To expect here on Extra Time from Matt Doyle. That's just wonderful. All right,
who
quick
missed
hits
the
here.
who missed the
yeah,
who
yeah, that's yeah. too deep a cut. That's too deep.
Okay. Orlando 1, Chicago nothing. Yeah, a tough moment for the 18-year-old U.S. Youth International midfielder Gutierrez in for Shaqiri. Two yellows, two sort of silly yellows, too, and Ezra was not particularly happy about that, as you saw from his reaction on the sideline, as well as his quote afterwards. But, yeah, no Shaqiri, no party, really, for the Fire. They're trying to figure out how to just create chances. They do not generate very much right now. Torres is going to be a big addition for them. And on the other side, Orlando looked pretty good, just can't finish. Just want to say, you know, Pato dropped into the MLS after dark just as I was praising him, saying, look, don't try to push me off my take. I was there last year. I'll stick around from newcomer to comeback player of the year. Had an assist to Erkinkara in this game, who I think has been pretty good, even though he missed a pretty good chance as well. So Orlando, second place in the East on 11 points, despite not looking their best and not having their new signings, especially Facundo Torres, be at their best. So I think feels like Orlando are in a good spot, despite the fact that Antonio Carlos is out for the season. We'll see how they address the center back spot, but a big 1-0 win for them. Doyle, how about Montreal? 2-1 against the Red Bulls.
Yeah, I mean, Montreal have had low-key one of the toughest schedules in the league. I think four of their six games so far have been on the road, 6 of 8. They also had CCL mixed in there, and they took a beating earlier in the year because of CCL, frankly. They're just not built with the depth to handle both competitions. But over the last three games, they've taken 7 points, and I think all three of those games were on the road. In this one, they were not the better team for most of it. I thought for 65, 70 minutes, I thought the Red Bulls were the better team. But Montreal had the ability to stick around. They were, I think, much more solid defensively, much more solid in goal. And then this team, if they get that sort of wind in their sails, they have the attacking pieces who can hurt you. And in this case, it was, you know, Georgi Mihailović, Kai Kamara, you know, Victor Wanyama pushing out of midfield, like doing
Carlos
the type
Cornell.
Of stuff. Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to say. And then, and then they took advantage of a really uncharacteristic blunder from Carlos Cornell.
Truly.
He has been awesome since about late July, maybe early August of last year. Like, you know, not quite Andre Blake, Matt Turner level, but like a half step down from that. He has been awesome. And then on top of it, he is the best sweeper keeper in the league. And on that play, he was the worst sweeper keeper in the league. And like, credit to Romel Kyoto for, you know, being on his toes and being committed enough to put Cornell under pressure in that spot and sometimes to get a gift. And look, with the way Montreal's schedule has gone and the sort of bad luck that they've had at times, they probably deserved a little bit of good luck. So it was, you know, it was not exactly 3 points earned, but I think they should be pretty happy with it. And I'm more confident in this team now than I don't want to say more confident because I was always confident, but like, it's nice to see that my confidence has been borne out. They're finishing up. I think they have an away date and then one more road game. So it'll be six of their first eight on the road. And they have like a pretty strong home schedule. So we'll figure out by like the end of May if this team can be as good as I think all of us think we are. Because to me, this is still a top five team in the Eastern Conference.
Yep. RSL2, Toronto FC2, bangers only for the TFC homegrowns in this one. A lot of yelling about for RSL fans about the goal that Jaden Nelson scored and whether he fouled Krylock. Great, great, great refereeing in my opinion on that one. Never, ever, ever a foul. There was a little contact, so I understand why the VAR flagged it, but I love Marcos Oliveira saying, uh-uh. That's just soccer, man. There's a little contact there, but he wins the ball. Krylock's not really in possession. 50-50, keep it rolling. Banger, what are you doing, Zach McMath? But also got a shout-out. Among a lot of good crowds this weekend, great crowd in Utah, great crowd in Frisco, but that was a fun game to watch, and especially fun if you're a part of the Play Your Kids movement. I like to hear those youngsters talking about the culture right now that Bob Bradley's building. It's still early days. I'm very curious to see what they look like when Insigne gets there in the summer. How about Sporting Kansas City 1, Nashville 2, Kalen? After this match, Johnny Russell went to confront supporters in the stands who were, I don't know what they were saying. They say they weren't saying anything over the line. I don't know what they were saying, but Johnny Russell definitely wasn't happy about it. And we had a bunch of people hitting us up saying the wheels are falling off in Kansas City. Andrew Sherman says, what's wrong with Kansas City and how do you fix it? What is wrong with Kansas City? Meanwhile, Nashville keep the road points rolling. They've got 10 now from six games, which is two more than what Gary Smith had hoped for from eight games. So congrats to them.
Without knowing anything and doing any research, I'm going to go ahead and back Johnny Russell on this one. Anyways, we'll move on. Mainly just because I feel like some Sporting fans have given me a hard time in the past. But I'm going to say for Nashville, just like continuing to roll. And I think coming from behind as well says something about this team. And just like they might as well just keep playing on the road at this point. Just like keep the good times rolling. And just when you get a string of results on the road, it just becomes like second nature to understand how to play these games. This one, they get a set piece goal as well. And, you know, for both sides, Nashville doesn't need to commit a ton of numbers to the attack. And I think the way that we're seeing Sporting Kansas City struggle, is if you can get Fontas, especially, dragged out and isolated, he really struggles. His foot speed, his recovery speed, and then even just one-on-one, just watching games throughout this year, he can really get beat one-on-one. Now he's good with the ball. He generally has good positioning to not put himself in these positions, but if you can drag him out at all, things can get really disconnected quickly for this Sporting Kansas City team. So I think that's kind of one of the bigger issues as far as the back line for them. And then for Nashville, you know, only word of caution I would say is I've done these road trips in a while where you put yourself in a good position. I did it in Chicago and in Houston. And it's not guaranteed that you're going to come back and get the home results to put you over the top. And we've seen this Nashville team as well not always close out everything at home as far as taking draws to wins. Done a really good job of it on the road so far this season. But I would say it's not, they've probably already exceeded their target number as far as what they wanted. I think, did Gary Smith come out and put a number on it?
Yeah, eight.
Eight? Okay. So, yeah, they've got, what, 10 now?
Yeah, 10. They're good to go.
Yeah. And their next game is away to San Jose, I believe. So you'd feel good about their chances in that. They have to go to LA, I think, after that, which would be a tougher match. But you also wouldn't put them past it to get a result in that. So they might be, you know, well above their target number, but it doesn't mean you're automatically going to come home and get those results. So I think it's how it'll be a challenge for Smith to kind of flip the script a little bit to say, we played this way on the road for, you know, eight games or 10 games, whatever it is. How do we now modify that without completely losing what's made us successful to this point?
I want to just real quick on the Sporting Kansas City side, what strikes me with them, it's not just losing Pulido, though that's obviously a big deal. I think he sort of brings out the best in Johnny Russell and Daniel Shaoui, even when he didn't play a ton last year, when he did play. I think he just changes the way that they're able to attack teams. And those guys had maybe once-in-a-lifetime seasons. We'll see. TBD on that one. I just feel like over the past 4 or 5 years or so, that transition from a previous generation to a new generation and the mixing of that and the building of depth is an area that Kansas City has had some struggles, whether it be the homegrown signings they've made, none of which stuck, and one of them which went to Charlotte and Jalen Lindsey, whether it be the like foreign signings, and I'm thinking of like Martins and Puncich and, you know, even Izzy Matt Marine and others. Fontas for a while was a failure too, and he had the one good year, and now it's like a TBD for them. Like, I just, they haven't got sort of that squad transition and freshening that you have to be successful long-term, and they have been successful long-term, but it feels a little bit like they're getting obviously wobbly there at the bottom of the West with 6 points right now through seven games. Okay, Vancouver 2, Portland 3. Go watch the highlights from just stoppage time. Nijgoda got a goal. That's good for the Timbers. Mabiala's back. That's good for the Timbers. Claudio Bravo is a PK machine in the wrong direction. That's bad for the Timbers, but they did win 3-2 against Vancouver. So a big result for them in Cascadia. Let's get to our CCL preview. You have Cruz Azul, Pumas, with Pumas up 2-1 on Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern on FS1 in Pumas and Tudien. And then you have NYCFC down 3-1 hosting at Red Bull Arena at 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursday against the Sounders. We'll have a live watch-along show for that Wednesday night on YouTube, so come hang out as the guys watch the show with you. We have a email here. Nick from the Wife Children House YouTube channel, which I've joked is my alias. His description of his YouTube channel is Major League Soccer, Sketch Comedy, and Church. This is the Lord's Prayer, an MLS version, and this is, you know, all respect to you, Nick, like, at the intersection of strange and soccer that we tend to inhabit on the daily. Anders, please give me this. Thank you. Thank you. Everyone settle down, please. Gather here for the good word. Our Father and Commissioner Garber, hallowed be thy game. Interesting to put Commissioner Garber in that category there. No offense. I mean, respect to him. But thy league has come through franchise expansion and soccer-specific and modified stadiums. Give us this day our daily game, and forgive us our backpasses, as we forgive those who counterpressed against us. And lead us not into bad tackles, but deliver us from VAR. Anyway, the full sermon and prayer on his YouTube channel, Wife, Children, and House, that is, I don't know what to make of that, other than I wanted to play organ music on this show, and so we did it. All right, well, what do you think of the games? What do you think? Does NYCFC have a chance to turn this around?
Yes.
Need a 2-0 win. Ronnie Dial has been talking about it for a week. Both were off this weekend, got fully rested.
Break the match into halves. Get one in the first half and kind of push on from there. I think the challenge will be, from what we saw, how good Seattle looked, is to see if they can, you know, keep from conceding. But I think definitely New York City is still in this one. But yeah, I think that first half will be important for them.
What's the key, Doyle, for both teams?
Do we know what's the status with Maxi?
We don't, but my guess is, knowing absolutely nothing about trunk injuries, but being absolutely delighted by the way they're described, is that he probably will not be available. But yeah. I could be wrong.
They felt his absence. Even the way he connects with Santi Rodriguez just didn't quite connect, and he wasn't able to get on the game as much. And in that stretch run we saw with them last year, just what a different team they are with him in the lineup. So that one is concerning for me.
Yeah, if they don't have Maxi, they have no chance. Like, that is just how it is with NYCFC. And it's not that their attack is heliocentric in the same way that Minnesota's is around Bibello, but like, he's more than just their best chance creator. He's also their best organizer. He's a huge part of their press as well. He's a huge part of turning defense into offense. And without him, they miss so much. That's one. And two is, like, Seattle just played so damn well last week. And I went back and I watched that game. And, like, Seattle's Seattle, right? They're always going to be devastating on the break, especially, you know, they play a little bit of a lower line. And, you know, with Roldan's movement, his movement is insanely good. So playing him as a winger full time now just opens up more of the field for those guys. But a huge part of it was just how good Albert Rusnak was playing as that number eight. Because now, if you're, and this is no, like, Obed Vargas was really good filling in earlier in the season, you know, paired up with Jao Paulo in the two line of that 4-2-3-1. But Rusnak, he made it so that you always have an outlet if you're a Seattle center back or goalkeeper or fullback, and they were just able to slice through NYCFC's press and turn like any bit of defensive aggression that NYCFC showed into a counterattack going the other direction. And the thing is, like, up 3-1, Seattle's going to be able to sit back. NYCFC has to show aggression. NYCFC's going to be playing with at least one, maybe two backup fullbacks. Their center backs have been kind of a mess so far this year. It's just a lot of things staring at you that say, like, yeah, Seattle's probably going to get one, maybe two on the break. And if that's the case, like, do you really back this NYCFC team with the way they've played to beat Steph Fry three times? I don't.
Well, that's an upper for NYCFC fans right there. Woo! Well, we'll see.
Seattle's like, here's the thing. Ander starts giving me good stuff for my column on the weekend. It just, like, takes a little bit of that burden. I start saying nice things about the Sounders. That's just the way it goes, man.
It's just now you're just Ander's the Sounders mouthpiece here on the show. No, just kidding. But big game. Whoever wins it bears mentioning and is abundantly obvious, like banging you over the head with a frying pan. We're going to have an MLS team in the CCL final. Whether it'll be against Cruz Azul or Pumas is TBD. We'll find that out on Tuesday. And we'll find out which order the hosting is going to be this week as well. We are trying to be at the second leg, wherever that second leg is. You know, got to witness history, et cetera, et cetera. And whether it's painful history or joyous history, I must be there. So we will try to figure out how we're going to do that and let you know about any sort of travel and or content coming out of that. Let's finish with one question in the mailbag. We've had a lot of voices from listeners, and we appreciate you and love you. So far, that's from Chad Young. You can hit us up, 401-206-0MLS or extratime@mlssoccer.com via email or just tweet at us at extratime, usually Monday mornings, Thursday mornings. I put out a tweet looking for mail and your comments, so look out for those. Chad Young says, I know the national team isn't top of mind, but with the latest Reyna injury, does the USMNT have to kind of assume he won't be around for Qatar? Do they have to operate in that way? How does that change the plans for the summer windows with this squad?
I haven't thought it all the way through yet. It's grim. I just hope the kid is able to get back and get healthy. If it doesn't happen for this World Cup, you know, there's another one coming up in 4 years, and we've seen players start their careers really injury prone and figure it out, figure out their bodies. Hopefully that's what happens with Gio. As for what it means for this summer, Berhalter's already said that he's going to take something close to the A team for the Nations League and then the two friendlies. I think it just, you know, potentially if Gio's not fit to go, and it seems pretty obvious that he's not going to be fit to go, that just reopens the door for someone like Paul Areola, Jordan Morris, Christian Roldan, you know, guys on that winger depth chart, though. I guess I don't know if Roldan is on Berhalter's winger depth chart, though he should be. It opens the door for those guys to maybe carve out a bigger role. But it's depressing because Gio Reyna is one of the two most talented players in the entire U.S. national team pool, regardless of age. And I hope he's able to get healthy enough to live up to that.
I had to let the horn breathe.
Yeah, right.
He also can play multiple positions. Like, he can play on either side. He can play underneath. And so just even from a flexibility standpoint, depending on the matchup goes, he's a guy that you can use in a lot of different ways. And just, like, just thinking about the moments of, you know, we have, I would say, the difference between the gulf between the names you mentioned and Gio is pretty wide. And just as far as, like, those moments where you can find somebody who does something completely off script, it limits us as far as that goes. You just think of that run against Mexico and some of the plays where you probably should pass the ball and it's not, or you do something off script. And, you know, we've seen Pulisic, even the amount that teams can focus on Pulisic, that changes the balance towards the other side of the field. The winger position, we do have some good depth there. Aronson, especially, I feel like, might be able to carve out a bigger role. I mean, when you look at the names of the people where I see those players as maybe being able to now take a step forward, but as far as from like a starter's position, that might open up the door more for Aronson to get a look, depending on which position and how we use Weah. But yeah, I'm still refusing to hold out, to give up on that. And I would say, as far as planning goes, you're always going to have a spot for Gio if he's healthy. So I don't think from like a planning standpoint, it's going to change from that. You just hope that maybe it limits his readiness in a way as far as like what role he might be able to play at the World Cup if he is. But I'm holding out hope.
Yeah, like November is still relatively a long time away. So probably just better to keep it quiet, let him do his work in the background, get back. It seems pretty clear he won't be coming back for Dortmund this year. That's probably a good thing for him. Focus on the body over the summer, get a baseline, and like for U.S. fans, hopefully see him in the World Cup. You certainly feel for the kid. The emotion on his face is relatable, understandable, just absolutely gutted. We'll see what can happen there. Knock on wood. All right, that's it for us. Hit us up. Let us know what you think about this week. Watch GA Cup live right now, RSL Tigres on YouTube, just to give you a hint of and Twitch of what you could be checking out with Dave and Bobby Warshaw and many, many others. And also, MLS Today is doing some special shows this week. They're not going to be on Twitch. They are all podcasts. So go subscribe and listen to the MLS Today podcast feed. You get the power rankings on there as well as MLS After Dark, too. So if you're looking for something between call up and extra time, that's a good place to start. And that's it for us. Enjoy your week, everybody. Adios.